You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and thank you for joining The American Revolution. This week, episode 303, John's Island. Now, last week, we covered the continued fighting in South Carolina, following the surrender of the main British Southern Army under General Cornwallis at Yorktown, Virginia. In South Carolina, General Nathanael Greene and the militia under General Francis Marion were pushing the British into an ever-shrinking circle around Charleston. The new British commander in Charleston, General Alexander Leslie, was consolidating his forces as best he could to hold on to whatever parts of the state that he could. Both sides remained concerned that some peace settlement might rely on what territories the armies held at the time, meaning that forcing the British out of Charleston entirely would help ensure recognition of South Carolina's independence. And with word of the victory at Yorktown, General Thomas Sumter returned to Greene's camp. And you may recall back in episode 292, General Sumter had tried to pretty much disband his militia army and personally traveled back to North Carolina to take a break. Part of this was Sumter's anger at orders from Greene and Governor Rutledge to stop the looting of Loyalist properties, which Sumter relied on to pay his army. Remember, part of what he was doing was capturing slaves that belonged to Loyalists to pay his soldiers for their continued service. General Sumter had also lost the faith of General Francis Marion and his militia, as well as Greene and the Continentals, for Sumter's poor leadership at Quinby's Bridge. So, with most people unhappy with him, as well as he with them, Sumter tried, as I said, to disband his army and go home, at least for a few months' time out. After Sumter's departure, General Greene and Governor Rutledge had put Francis Marion in charge of most of the militia. With Sumter's return, he was more senior to Marion and could reasonably reclaim command of the militia. But everyone was annoyed with him, and no one really wanted that to happen. At the same time, Greene wanted to avoid a major political fight between Sumter and Marion and their respective factions, so he gave them separate commands. Greene was moving Marion's men to the area around Charleston, primarily to the south, where they wanted to prevent any British overland travel between Charleston and Savannah, as well as making it more difficult for the British to forage in those areas. At the same time, Greene tasked Sumter with keeping a lid on Tory activity around Orangeburg, which was up to the northwest of Charleston. There was still a large German-speaking Loyalist population there that required continued monitoring so that they did not regroup and try to cause more problems. During this same time, which was late November of 1781, we still have William Bloody Bill Cunningham wreaking his havoc in the area, something that I talked about last week. Sumter was tasked with taking on Cunningham and his men as well, working with General Andrew Pickens to take out these Tories who were still committing atrocities across the state. The other key officer, besides Sumter, who was returning to South Carolina at this time, was Colonel John Lawrence. Lawrence was a Continental officer, so he came under the direct command of General Greene. But Lawrence was more than just a colonel. He was the son of the former president of the Continental Congress, Henry Lawrence. The Lawrence family headed one of the wealthiest and most powerful families in South Carolina. Colonel Lawrence had recently completed a diplomatic mission to France to obtain more French assistance for the Continental Army. Colonel Lawrence had been General Washington's aide for many years and was close friends with people like the Marquis de Lafayette and Alexander Hamilton. His political connections made him far more important than his rank might suggest. Lawrence had returned from France in time to rejoin the Continental Army for the Yorktown campaign. he had led one of the regiments in the final assault on Redoubt No. 10 at Yorktown, and then was part of the negotiating team that accepted Cornwallis's surrender. In a touch of irony, in addition to his military title as a general, Cornwallis held the position as Constable of the Tower of London. That, of course, was where Lawrence's father, Henry Lawrence, was currently a prisoner. So Colonel Lawrence had effectively captured his father's jailer. Following the surrender at Yorktown, Lawrence tried to get approval to exchange Cornwallis for his father. That was still undecided when Washington left Yorktown for Philadelphia, and Lawrence finally returned to South Carolina. After his arrival in early December, Lawrence began to push for a number of political changes in addition to offering his military services. Lawrence began working with Marion's efforts south of Charleston, working closely with Light Horse Harry Lee's Legion. Colonel Lee had also just returned to South Carolina after a trip to Virginia that lasted about 2 months. Greene had sent Lee back to Virginia in September, hoping that Lee could persuade General Washington to send more reinforcements to South Carolina. The hope of getting more reinforcements was largely unsuccessful, but it did allow Lee to observe the end of the Yorktown campaign and be present at Cornwallis's surrender. Lee's Legion set up camp at McQueen's Plantation, just west of Charleston, with an eye toward taking John's Island, just south of the city. Where Lee was close enough to Charleston that he could see what was happening in the city. He was also close enough that he had several conflicts with Loyalist militia. On December 19th, a company of Lee's soldiers, under the command of Captain James Armstrong, attacked a Loyalist company under the command of Captain Ludwig Keenan, killing several and taking the rest prisoner, including Captain Keenan. The following day, Captain Armstrong was waiting to meet a spy at Garden's Plantation when he spotted another company of Loyalists. This time, the enemy was a company of New York Provincials commanded by Major John Coffin. A native of Boston, Coffin was a Loyalist who joined the British Army very early in time to fight for Bunker Hill. By 1777, he had risen to Major, commanding Loyalist volunteers from the New York area. Coffin and his New York Provincials had been deployed south, where they saw considerable action in South Carolina and Georgia. Commanders in Charleston had tasked Coffin with tracking down the rebels who had captured Major Keenan the day before. When Coffin's provincials saw the enemy under Armstrong, they withdrew. Armstrong's Patriot militia gave chase. The Loyalist withdrawal had been an effort to draw the enemy into an ambush, and they were successful. Captain Armstrong's men quickly found themselves being attacked from all sides by a larger force. Armstrong charged at the enemy, but they did not break. Armstrong's company was cut down, with most of the men killed or captured. Armstrong's horse fell, and a Loyalist soldier took him prisoner. Perhaps that was the most fortunate thing that could have happened to Armstrong at the time, because the Loyalist who captured him had to fight off several of his own comrades to keep them from killing Armstrong. The following day, the Loyalists exchanged Armstrong for the return of Captain Kiernan. As 1781 was coming to an end, the active skirmishing just continued. On December 23rd, a small militia company under the command of Captain Benjamin Odin was camped in a field northwest of Blackville, about a day's march from Orangeburg. A group of Loyalists attacked in a pre-dawn raid, killing 16 men and forcing the rest to scatter. The dead and dying were left in the field for several days, giving it the name Slaughter Field. Another terrible story of attacks and revenge was unfolding further to the south. Near the southern tip of South Carolina, a local Patriot militia held Hilton Head Island. Just to the south, on Defusky Island, a Loyalist regiment held sway. In late December, a group of Loyalists under the command of Captain Philip Martinengel crossed the water over to Hilton Head to ambush a Patriot militia officer, Captain Ambrose Devant. The Loyalists caught Devant riding near his plantation and shot him. The wounded Patriot was able to escape and ride to a neighbor's plantation, but his wound was mortal and he soon died, but not before telling his friends that Martinengel's Loyalists had shot him. Devon's friend, Captain John Leecraft, organized a retaliatory raid. His patriots crossed over to Defosky Island in search of Martinengel. They found him on Christmas night in bed. According to one account, Martinengel was sleeping with his infant daughter next to him. The patriots slit his throat, killing him without waking his daughter. The daughter awoke later from the feel of her father's blood covering her body. Her screams alerted the servants. Incidents like this were happening all over South Carolina. Neighbors continued to attack neighbors, often simply out of revenge. Loyalists were growing increasingly desperate, while patriots were looking to end the violence of those who refused to accept the apparent patriot victory. While General Greene was trying to tamp down this cycle of revenge, his main army was still trying to focus on tightening the noose even further on the British in Charleston itself. Greene knew that the local skirmishing throughout the state would only end once the British were forced to abandon Charleston entirely. Greene was still pushing to get an army large enough to take out Charleston directly, but that didn't look like it was going to happen anytime soon. So, in the meantime, he was focused on harassing British troops around the edges of Charleston. With Greene's support, Colonels Lee and Lawrence targeted John's Island for their next attack. This island sits just south of Charleston, a few miles below the city. British ships protected the island. James Craig and the 82nd of Foot, which had recently evacuated from Wilmington, North Carolina, had been assigned to protect the island. Craig had just received a promotion to lieutenant colonel and commanded a brigade of about 500 regulars and loyalists. The British used the island primarily to graze horses as well as cattle needed to feed the garrison at Charleston. The patriots did not have boats to cross over onto the island, but determined that there were a couple of times each month when the tide was low enough at night that they could cross over through waist-high water to get to the island. This sort of attack would be especially risky since the tide was only low enough for a few hours. The troops would have to cross over, conduct their raid, and then retreat back to the main island before the water rose too high. Otherwise, they would find themselves trapped on the island. The raiding force planned to cross on the night of December 28th. The men got into position, but discovered there was another large British force on nearby James Island. If the patriots attacked John's Island, these reinforcements would leave them outnumbered and potentially trapped on the island. In the end, Lee and Lawrence called off the attack. They would have to wait another 2 weeks for the tides to be low enough at the right time of night to try again. On the night of January 12, 1782, they made their second attempt. This time, the army under General Greene was camped nearby. If necessary, it could cause a diversion in case the British tried to send reinforcements to John's Island. Lawrence sent the 1st Division, under Lee's command, across the shallows at about 1 a.m. on the 13th. As the men crossed silently, they could hear British soldiers on nearby gunships calling out, "All's safe." Lawrence was supposed to oversee a second column under the command of James Hamilton to get across the cut, but Hamilton's division was missing when it was time for them to cross. They finally showed up over an hour later, with Hamilton informing Lawrence that their guide had abandoned them and they got lost. At this point, the tide was already beginning to rise. In a few hours, it would be light. Lee's division would be trapped on the island with too few men to engage the enemy. Lawrence again called off the attack and recalled Lee's division back to the mainland. After this attempt, the leadership decided that a land crossing dependent on the tide simply wouldn't work. They decided they would have to attack with boats. To do that, they would need to drive off the British gunboats that were protecting the island. Greene brought up artillery to fire on the boats the following day. This resulted in a back-and-forth artillery duel between the Continental artillery on land and the British gunboats, but the British boats refused to withdraw. Hearing the artillery fire and fearing a full assault on the island, Colonel Craig opted to evacuate his regulars and militia. They pulled off the island as the gunboats dueled with the Continentals. The following day, after the British had abandoned the island, the British gunboats also withdrew. On the 15th, Colonel Lawrence led a small force of cavalry and infantry onto John's Island, confirming that the British camp had in fact been abandoned. They managed to capture a few stragglers and a few supplies, but the enemy was mostly gone. They did engage in a firefight with a British schooner that was loaded with most of the regimental supplies, but after a brief exchange of fire, the schooner escaped. Craig ended up moving his regulars and loyalists to James Island, which was just to the north of John's Island, but was within cannon shot of Charleston itself. With John's Island abandoned, but too risky to hold, the Continentals also withdrew from the island, leaving it a no man's land. To the north of Charleston, Greene relied on local militia to keep the British in check. General Marion had spread out the militia in small groups to cover a large area of land. Back in Charleston, British General Leslie believed that the small and scattered groups of Patriot militia would be vulnerable to attack. As a result, he deployed Major William Brereton, a British officer in command of provincial troops. Brereton came from an Irish family that had moved to England in the 1500s. His ancestor and namesake had been a courtier to Henry VIII. His family had a long military tradition. His father and uncles had all been officers. One of his older brothers had been killed while serving under General Braddock at the Battle of the Monongahela. William had purchased his first ensign's commission at the age of 17 in 1769. By the time the Revolutionary War began, he was a captain of a grenadier company. He served in the Philadelphia campaign and purchased a promotion to major in April of 1781. Brereton was a highly experienced officer, and the men under him were battle-hardened provincials. Brereton led a brigade which included his own regiment of regulars, as well as several smaller regiments of loyalist provincials, including the mounted New York provincials under Major John Coffin. In all, Brereton had a force of about 360 men. His men crossed from Charleston onto Daniels Island to the north, searching for food and any enemy that cared to take on their forces. In response to this move, Militia Colonel Richard Richardson Jr. led a local militia to confront the enemy. Now, you may recall I've mentioned Richardson's father before. He had been a prominent patriot who served in the government and also as a militia general. Richardson Sr. had been captured at Charleston when the British invaded in 1780. After getting very ill, he was released on parole, but died at home a few weeks later. You may recall an earlier episode I discussed where Bannister Tarleton dug up General Richardson's body and desecrated it in an attempt to goad the Patriots. So Richardson's son, Colonel Richard Richardson Jr., continued his father's tradition of supporting the Patriot cause as a military leader. Now, he had some experience, but his brigade of militia that he put together for this had not really fought together as a unit. When he learned of the advance of the British on Daniel Island, he called on General Marion to send reinforcements. Marion could not do much, but he did send a regiment of South Carolina Dragoons to assist. In total, after the Dragoons arrived, Richardson's militia force totaled about 400 men, a bit larger than the enemy he faced. On January 3rd, the British were camped at Brabant Plantation, the home of Reverend Robert Smith. Aware that the rebel militia might be in the area, Major Brereton deployed a guard at nearby Voodoo's Bridge, one of the main approaches to the plantation. Richardson approached the bridge in an attempt to reconnoiter the enemy. The British picket spotted him and tried to apprehend him. Richardson fled back to his army, with the loyalist provincials chasing closely behind. Once he reached his own lines, he wheeled around his horse and ordered his men to charge. The South Carolina Dragoons charged forward, forcing the provincials to withdraw back to Vidieu's Bridge. There, Major Coffin led a countercharge with his provincial cavalry. Many of the Patriot militia scattered and ran. Some remained, but they were heavily outnumbered and cut down by the British. As the Patriot militia fled, the provincials pursued them, chasing soldiers for about 6 miles in a running battle. Afraid that they would be drawn too far away from their lines, the provincials eventually gave up the chase and returned. At the end of the day, the Americans lost 9 killed, 6 wounded, and 15 missing. The British reported 4 killed, 14 wounded, and 1 captured. With the American militia scattered, though, the British continued their foraging. A week and a half later, the provincial militia under Major Coffin had ridden much further inland, in fact all the way back to Dorchester, the site of another skirmish about 6 weeks earlier that I discussed last week. There, Coffin's horsemen managed to surprise a small patrol of Continental Dragoons under the command of Lieutenant John Kelly. Taken by surprise, Kelly surrendered along with 7 of his men. Coffin brought them back to Charleston as prisoners. This is sometimes known as the Second Battle of Dorchester, although there really didn't seem to be much, if any, fighting on that day. These actions seemed to end British field operations for a time. Most of the soldiers returned to Charleston, or very close to the city. Because they had lost so much grazing land, General Leslie ordered the destruction of 200 horses that they could no longer feed and did not want to fall into the hands of the enemy. Similarly, though, the Patriots were also finding it difficult to feed their horses. Around this same time, South Carolina Governor Rutledge ordered the state troops and militia to send home their horses, as the state would no longer pay to feed them. This actually led to many of the militia going home as well, since the men did not want to fight on foot. With both sides running so low on supplies, the skirmishing seemed to slow down for the next few weeks. And this lull in fighting also coincided with the return of civil government to South Carolina. In late 1781, the state had held new legislative elections, and the new legislature met in early 1782 to put some new policies in place for the state. And we'll discuss those policies next week as the legislature handles several important issues for the future of South Carolina.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show, part of the Airwave Media Network. Thanks to my Patreon supporters in the Alexander Hamilton Club, George Davis, Mike Hager, John Celentano, Michael Mulhern, and the Sons of the American Revolution. You can check out the Sons podcast at fastfunhistory.com. Also thanks to Robert Morris Circle supporters Patrick LeBeau and Kurt Avard. I also want to welcome new Patreon supporters at the Standard Bearer level, Brian Wilkerson, Tristan Robbs, and Matt Selman. Everyone who supports this podcast on Patreon at the $10 level or higher gets a free new magnet each month with a different flag from the American Revolution. It's my way of saying thank you for supporting this podcast. Also, if anyone would like to support the podcast but just make a one-time contribution, I gratefully accept gifts via PayPal and Venmo. Links on my blog and website. Another easy way to support the show is to click on one of the Amazon book links that I add to each blog episode or my book recommendation on the podcast page. If you use these links when you do your Amazon shopping, I get a small commission on all of your purchases. You don't have to buy the book that's on the link. Just use that link to get to Amazon and then start searching for whatever you were going to buy anyway. It's a great way to support the podcast without spending any money that you weren't going to spend anyway. So this past Wednesday, we held our American Revolution Roundtable meeting on Zoom, where we discussed the life of Jemima Warner, one of the lesser-known heroines of the American Revolution. I really got fascinated to learn about Jemima Warner a few years ago. It really was an interesting discussion. The great thing about the Zoom meeting is, of course, unlike the podcast, we can chat back and forth, you can ask questions, we can share information. It's a really great time, and we hold one every single month. They're on Zoom, so if you want to participate, you're more than welcome to join us. If you want to get notices of these events, please join my mailing list on MailChimp. There are links on my website and blog at the bottom of each episode. For anyone who wasn't able to participate live, I am going to publish the recording of the podcast next week. I publish that on Patreon, but I make it public, so anybody, whether you're a Patreon donor or not, can go there and listen to the recording of our roundtable. So this week, we discuss some continuing skirmishing in South Carolina, which really continues to be a brutal affair. One of the British officers I highlighted this week was Major Mark Coffin, who was originally from Boston. He was actually the son of a customs officer in Boston, and he obtained a commission in the regular army at the beginning of the war and went on to command a regiment of New York provincials. The regiment was known as the King's American Regiment. These guys were very active and effective soldiers throughout the war, first in the New York and Philadelphia areas, and then later in the South. When the war ended, Coffin moved to Canada, as did many men from his regiment. He did pretty well for himself there in land speculation, and also served in a number of local legislative positions, and he helped raise troops in Canada for the War of 1812. He eventually rose to the rank of general and had a pretty successful life and career, despite not doing particularly well in the American Revolution. My book recommendation this week takes a closer look at the ongoing skirmishing between patriots and loyalists in South Carolina. It's called The Partisan War, The South Carolina Campaign of 1780 to 1782 by Russell F. Wigley. This is really more of a booklet than a book. It's only about 75 pages long. Wigley wrote it as part of South Carolina's tricentennial celebration in 1970. It doesn't cover any specific details about the events I covered in this week's episode, but it really does give a good overview of the local war that was fought in South Carolina during the last years of the Revolution. The author was a history professor at Temple University in Philadelphia for many years. He's written many books about military history. A lot of them cross through many different eras, but he has written a few books about the American Revolution. He also wrote a few really good ones on the American Civil War. This book, The Partisan War, as I said, was published in 1970, and although you can find the book for sale, you can also just peruse it on archive.org. As I said, it's not a very long book, so you may want to go that way. My online recommendation is a brief online biography of one of the other British officers I mentioned this week, William Brereton. The article's by Mark Odens, who actually did a really cool dissertation on the British officer corps in the late 1700s. I wish I could recommend his dissertation, but it's not publicly available. He wrote his dissertation at the University of Michigan, where I'm an alumnus, and even I couldn't get at the dissertation with my login there. Don't get me started about firewalls. I find them very frustrating, and I don't want to digress into a rant about them. But we'll have to settle for this relatively short but public article about Brereton that Mark Odens published. As always, I've included links to it on my blog and website. My question this week comes from Chris Joseph, who asks about transatlantic communications. Specifically, I talked about word reaching France that the Americans and British were involved in peace talks back in 1776, but that word arrived a few days later that there would be no peace negotiations. So he asks, how does word travel so fast sometimes, but others not so much? Now, of course, communications in the age of sail was much slower, but it was also very inconsistent. In the comment that Chris raises about word arriving a few days after a different message had arrived, that was because both communications were in transit at the same time. One ship left America, another ship left with a different message a few days later, and so they arrived within a few days of each other in France. The best a sailing ship could do to cross the Atlantic at this time was about 3 weeks, and that was if everything just went right. The wind, the currents, the quality of the ship, everything. Normally, a trip would be expected to take 4 to 6 weeks. ships with expensive copper sheathing sailed faster. An older ship with a wood hull that had not been cleaned in a while might move much slower. Ships loaded down with more supplies would also sail much slower. Then, of course, if you had the right wind, if you had the right currents, as I said, all of these things could impact how long it would take for the ship to cross. If the winds or currents were bad, you may not even go in a straight line. You may have to zigzag, which, of course, would add a lot more distance to the travel. There were also times when a ship was damaged or blown off course or have other problems. So it was not unusual that a ship was supposed to sail, say, from London to New York to end up in some Caribbean port like the Bahamas after being blown there by a storm or having to make an unexpected detour. Once there, ships might often need repairs before continuing. This could mean that a trip that was expected to take a month might end up taking 3 months or more. And that's just the Atlantic crossing, of course. Sometimes a message also had to travel overland as part of the transit. For example, say there was an inland battle at King's Mountain. It might take a rider several days to reach the coast, especially if the courier had to worry about avoiding capture. Someone riding hard on really good roads could possibly make 60 or 70 miles a day, but that was really killing yourself. Someone in no real hurry might only ride 20 or 30 miles a day, and of course, if they were riding through forests or paths that were not really designed for fast riding, it could take even longer. If the courier made a few stops along the way, that could even extend the trip even more, and making stops was quite common. Riders could often get lost or have to take detours because a bridge was out or a river was too high. So, as I said, there was a lot of things that made travel time inconsistent. Once that message reached the coast, there would have to be a ship ready to go. Many ports didn't have message ships just sitting around waiting for a message. So the message might sit there for days or even weeks, maybe even months, before a ship could bring a message from, say, Charleston back to New York to inform the military commander. That commander would then have to send the message to London, and that process took time as well. Because messages weren't always sent directly, London officials might hear rumors about an event that happened days or weeks before official word arrived from their commanders. The bottom line is that communications were dependent on a great many variables which were out of the control of those doing the communicating. If you have a question you'd like me to answer, please reach out to me via email or on Twitter, Facebook, Quora, or Reddit. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.
What does Sputnik have to do with student loans? How did a set of trembling hands end the Soviet Union? How did inflation kill moon bases? And how did a former president decide to run for a second non-consecutive term? These are among the topics we deal with on the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics podcast. We tell stories of history that relate to today's news events. Give a listen. My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, wherever you get podcasts.